Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church, and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz, biz is spelled B-I-Z. So please enjoy today's guest, who founded a Christian ministry over 10 years ago called Hope Nottingham. He actively encourages other social action ministries by coordinating Christian Action, again in Nottingham. He used to be a company director at a structural engineering firm before becoming his local church's evangelist, which then led to setting up Hope Nottingham. Our guest has just had his first book published and available at all Christian bookshops, entitled Communities of Hope, Growing Christian Community Through Social Action. Our guest wants to encourage the work of God through ordinary people. So, what did his family think when he decided to stop being a company director? What also did the firm think? What did he have to give up so he could become the church's evangelist? Why did he want to start Hope Nottingham? What were the initial challenges? What is his definition of a community and a community of hope? All these questions, but to find out the answers, gives me great pleasure to welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, Nigel Adams. Nigel, thank you so much for joining us today. First question as always, where are you, sir?
Where am I? Well, first of all, hello. Thank you so much for inviting me to have a chat with you. I am sat in my lounge at this moment in time in Beeston in Nottingham.
Yeah, I think Nottingham might crop up quite a bit, actually, yeah, in this podcast.
It's a bit of a recurring theme, really. Yeah.
Well, we look forward to hearing more about it. But before we do, five important or not so important questions to ask you, good sir. So if you're sitting comfortably, let us begin. Question number one, if you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
That would have to be, I think, Nelson Mandela. I suppose I've grown up through the whole kind of apartheid era. I've never been to South Africa or anything. But that guy, he was 25 years in prison. And when he came out, and even before he came out, he was all about reconciliation. There was no bitterness. He basically wanted to work with his worst enemies to bring about reconciliation in his country, which I just think is extraordinary. And I kind of wanted to have a chat with him about that, is how did he, particularly when in his darkest moments, how did he manage to stay so gracious? Actually focused on the task, really, because what he wanted to do was kind of release his people from oppression. But he did it with such grace. I think that's extraordinary. I think he's one of the most extraordinary people of the 20th century and probably the 21st as well. I think it's an incredible example. So I'd just love to kind of get inside his head a little bit.
Yeah.
And try and understand how his mind works, because he's something amazing to learn from, really.
Yeah, especially how many years was he on Robben Island, and to see how big, should I say, how small his cell was.
Yeah.
Confined in that for a number of years. Unbelievable.
I mean, quite apart from anything else, I think I would have gone just completely mad in that situation, really. I'd have lost it, I'm sure. So that's, you know, just amazing person. And actually so just good-natured all around, really. What a lovely guy. So it's the kind of guy you just want to have a beer with, really. So whether he drinks beer, no idea. But, you know.
Most probably would have been a South African Merlot or something like that.
Something like that, yes, probably. Yeah.
Obviously, I remember him all of a sudden at the South African Rugby Union final, when it was obviously held in South Africa, and he just suddenly revealed underneath his jacket that he was wearing the South African rugby shirt. I thought that was phenomenal.
Just a very cool guy.
Do you remember the gardening programme with Alan Titchmarsh and colleagues?
You know what? I do remember that very vaguely. Yeah, yeah. And he was, again, he's such a gentle guy, really.
Yeah.
He was really... such interest in everything Alan Titchmarsh had to say.
Yeah. For some reason, they went down to South Africa. I can't remember what they were doing, but they were doing it, I think, for a charity that he was a patron of. And then Mr. Mandela turned up and they had a chat. And he just, as you say, seemed so gracious. It was phenomenal.
Yeah. Amazing.
Good choice. A very good choice. Thank you. Question two. Who is your favourite biblical character, Nigel, or favourite biblical story, or favourite parable?
I mean, obviously, this is really hard to choose. There's quite a bit to choose from. But I always go to this. There's a particular story in the Bible that has such a profound impact on me and has done for a very long time. And I think of the story of Jesus washing the disciples' feet. Particularly when you read the story, it kind of begins with this phrase sort of along the lines of Jesus knew what was about to happen to him.
Yes.
And he was there with his closest friends, and he had an opportunity at that moment to kind of really give them his last words and show them what he was really like. And then what he does next is he takes off his cloak. And I always think that's so profound, because here's this Son of God who carries the whole glory of the heavens. And when he takes that cloak off, it's as if he's taking off all of his glory and shedding that aside and kneeling at the feet of his own followers to wash their feet. And it's just such an extraordinary, profound act. This is God.
Yeah, yeah.
He sets aside the whole glory of the universe to serve the people he created. And I just think that's an amazingly profound thing. And whenever I think about that, it still hits me. It still moves me that it's like Jesus is saying, this is what your God is truly like, one who will put everything aside to serve just you. And I just keep coming back to that time and time again. It demonstrates to me that Jesus is somebody that I can put all my trust in, because he's prepared to do anything for me, really.
That's a phenomenal answer. Yeah, and I do like the bit you said about taking his cloak off.
Extraordinary thing. Yeah, I never quite feel able to put it into words, really.
No, I think you did very well there. I'm pretty sure, along with Nottingham, that cloak story will be turning up again in the next hour.
Possibly, yeah, yeah.
Question number three. If you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be, please, Nigel?
Complete change of lane now, literally.
Oh, if it's frivolous, even better. Bring it on.
Cycle lanes. Cycle lanes. I often cycle to work. You couldn't describe me as a massively keen cyclist, but I often cycle to work. Uh-huh. Once a week, more or less, I go cycling with a friend of mine in the local nature reserve. I do like cycling. But cycle lanes drive me mad because they make no sense. So I would like cycle lanes actually to be designed by cyclists, because you experience it when you're cycling along. And there's quite a few cycle lanes in Nottingham, but quite a few of them are completely illogical. You can be cycling along a cycle lane, and it's often a cycle lane that's a shared footpath, which has its own challenges.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you'll see a sign that just says end of cycle lane. Nothing else, just end of cycle lane. And you think, well, where do we go now then? In Nottingham, there's the trams, and wherever there's a road junction and a tram junction, there's a little thing on the footpath that seems to indicate, with a cycle symbol on it, that seems to indicate you should come off the road and go across on the pavement or something at the traffic light junction. And I don't know why they're there, and they don't seem to make any sense. And whenever I follow them, I usually find that I end up having to avoid a pedestrian, because it just doesn't work. Again, I have a bit of a rant about it. Cycle lanes need to be designed by cyclists, but with a couple of supplementary rules.
Oh, good.
Where there are cycle lanes, cyclists should be required to use them, as opposed to, there's a particular stretch in Nottingham called University Boulevard, called that because it's a long dual carriageway with trees on it alongside the university. And there's a really good cycle lane alongside that, in fact, on both sides of the dual carriageway. But sometimes you still get cyclists on the main road in the dual carriageway with all the traffic whizzing along. And I thought, why are they doing that when there's a nice, safe cycle lane? So I think cycle lanes, where there aren't there, should be used.
Oh, very good. Like that.
And to add to that, and I don't know what the solution to that is, on my cycle ride into work, there's a stretch where you get close to where I'm working by the Queen's Medical Centre Hospital, where there's clearly lots of students around who don't seem to be able to distinguish between what is footpath, which is very clearly marked, and cycle lane, which is also very clearly marked. Maybe it needs to be colour-coded or something, so it's bright red or whatever, to be a cycle lane, because people just seem to ignore it. So you then end up with pedestrians walking along what is meant to be a designated cycle path. So it all gets a bit hairy, really. So that's my other supplementary rule, that where there is a cycle lane, it should only be used by cyclists to keep everybody safe, really.
Well, you're warming me up to the idea. You might do well as a Prime Minister on this one. I have to put in a counter-argument to make it go through Parliament.
Fair enough.
First of all, regarding students, well, that's because they can't read. They're only 18. They don't understand. So you have to give them some leeway.
I'm not sure that would go down well in the House of Commons as an argument, really.
Not used to sarcasm, are they? Oh, maybe actually, some MPs are, so I'll get away with that.
Yeah.
The second thing, though, is that there has to be a bigger punishment. And I can speak firsthand on this. My son and our friend, we went to see a gig in Belfast city centre a few months ago. And as we got to the traffic lights, right in the city centre, we were on the pedestrian pavement.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, this girl cycling along on the pavement,
yeah,
and she almost runs in and kills my friend. Okay, slight exaggeration, but you know, if it was a film, there'd be limbs flying all over the place. And she managed to say, sorry. Now, I'm sorry, not good enough. So we need a massive deterrent. Now, if you are riding on the pavement, what, 25 years harsh labour? I don't know.
25 years harsh labour. I mean, you have a point, and I think it's a reasonably fair point, but it is only really valid if the cycle lanes make sense in the first place. Because the reason that might have happened, because the poor innocent girl might have been cycling along happily on what appeared to be a cycle lane, and then next minute it's no longer a cycle lane because it's just not very clear.
No, it's very good of you to stand up for her. Yeah. You'd make, yeah, make a very good defence, barrister. No.
Okay.
Actually, maybe there was a cycle lane and she just thought she could then just nip onto the pavement. But in my day, growing up quite a few years ago now, when we had to do the Tufty Code or whatever it was called, we knew we weren't supposed to ride our bikes on the pavement. So what happened to that?
Well, that's part of the confusion, you see, because quite a lot of cycle lanes these days are on what are basically pavements. There's quite a few cases where it was at one time just pavements, and they've changed it into a cycle path. And you see these signs that have a line up middle, and on one side it is as a picture of pedestrians, and on the other side it has a picture of cyclists. And that's turned it into a shared cycle lane, which I would admit is not always the most sensible thing to do, when, particularly when you've got those cycle lanes that also got a tree growing across the middle of it. So you kind of, there just isn't room. But so it just needs sorting out. This is my point of the law, really.
Do you know what? We've spent more time talking on this than anything else so far. It's very, very well defended. I like this. It might have legs, together with a previous podcaster guest who said that she wanted a pavement to split up into slow walkways and fast moving walkways. You know, I thought that was a great answer. So
you
know, we've got three things for pavements now.
There you go.
Very good. And if you're in America and you're wondering what's a pavement, it's what you call a sidewalk, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. Question four, outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out so far, Nigel?
Gosh, I've got loads to choose from here. I'm going to go for, partly perhaps just because it's one of the most recent ones, last year we had a wonderful time away in North America, visiting some friends who were working over at the time. And the particular day, which just was a very magical kind of day, is we went on a little boat trip to watch bears in the wild in a place called Tofino on the Pacific Rim of Vancouver Island.
Oh, very nice.
Beautiful. And it is literally on the far edge of the world. That's what it really feels like when you're there. We went on this little boat trip and they take you to this really remote place where there was genuinely wild black bears who don't really come into contact with humans at all because they're on these little islands in the middle of nowhere. And you sit in the boat about 30 yards away from the bears and watch them foraging for crabs under the rocks, which we did. And it was extraordinary. The whole experience of it, watching the bears, was amazing because it was, we don't really often see wild animals, truly wild animals, really in their natural habitat, uninterrupted by humans. The slightly strange thing we're told is when you're in the boat, the bears just ignore you. They don't really see you as a threat or anything, partly because they're not used to dealing with humans anyway, but also because you're in the water, they just don't really identify with you. So they just completely ignore you, which is great because you just watch them lift. What they do is they lift rocks up to look for crabs and things. And when they get their crabs, they take it away and hide in the woods to eat their crab. And it was just amazing. But it was just the whole day because there was more to it than just the bears. The atmosphere was just going out on these boats that were in this really remote place in itself was wonderful. And then to finish it off, it was actually really early morning start to go and watch this because you have to go at the right time of the tides to get the bears at the right time. And then we came back to our little B&B accommodation afterwards. And the landlady at the place had been very kind to us and said, well, you're going out really early. Do you want breakfast really early or do you want breakfast when you come back? And actually, we went for breakfast when we come back because we didn't want to have to get up that early. And when we got back, she'd made for us these blueberry pancakes.
Ooh.
Blueberries grow in abundance in that part of the world. And they were just the most amazing things, one of the most amazing things I've ever eaten. So we had this wonderful long time out and about and watching bears and then coming back and enjoying a wonderful blueberry pancake brunch. And it was a very magical kind of day. That whole area of Tofino, which is miles away, not the easiest place to get to, was just a beautiful place. And if I had a helicopter or something, I'd go there frequently.
You'd think, though, the bears would say, well, hang on a minute, there's high tide and low tide. It's not fair. We'll come out on low tide as well. You think they'd sort of play to their audience, wouldn't you?
Well, you would think, except they just completely ignore the audience. That was almost the wonderful thing about it. They just didn't take any notice whatsoever of these humans watching them in a boat.
Well, no wonder they haven't won any Oscars then if they ignore the audience.
I'd have given them an Oscar anytime.
Excellent. Whenever I hear bears being mentioned, I keep thinking of my mate Yogi and his friend Boo Boo.
I don't know what the bears' names were. I don't think we ever found that out.
Question 5. What's been your most embarrassing moment then, please, Nigel?
Oh, my goodness me. Far too many of them as well, really. And I've tried to block them out, so I might need counselling after this. So the thing that finally came to mind, when I was about 17, I think, I was in a school play. It was this dreadful thing. I think it was based around the idea of the young people had taken over the government, and it was all very, very right on and cool for its time in the early 80s or whatever. I think it was a fairly awful thing. But there was a particular bit where there was four of us main characters that were kind of supposedly best of friends, and we were kind of escaping ourselves from the authorities, and we sang this song, and there was four of us, and we each had a verse to sing ourselves, and I sung the last verse. Now, the other three people that were singing could actually sing, and I can't sing. But the lines in my song I still remember to this day. It's clearly etched on my soul. The lines are, "These are my friends, and with them I'm not alone." Imagine me singing that completely out of tune. And then at that moment, as I'm singing it, my other three friends, what they do is kind of take a step sideways away from me as if to disown me because they didn't want anything to do with this idiot that can't sing. I mean, it was one of those situations where I think I realized afterwards just how embarrassing it was, because so many people commented on how brave I was to stand up and sing when clearly I cannot sing. My physics teacher particularly took great pleasure in pointing this out to me.
Thing is, though, obviously you did it deliberately, because if they were having to move away from you on the stage,
yeah,
you know, you obviously were proving that you could actually sing because you were like Les Dawson singing it badly. You know?
Yes, I mean, if I could make that claim that it was an intentional comedy moment, and that was the awful thing about it, it did become a comedy moment in a play that wasn't particularly funny. And it took me a little while to cotton on to read, because not only can I not sing, I can't tell whether I can sing well or not. I mean,
you'd be pleased to know that I found the clip and it's now on YouTube.
Yes.
If only it was there.
If only. Well, look, I think it was the year after or the year before. We were in Midsummer Night's Dream, which was much better. And I played Snug the Joiner in that. But I've still got a VHS videotape.
Well, if anyone has a VHS copy of Nigel singing deliberately out of tune, please let us know.
Spare us.
Nigel, thank you so much for those answers. I've mentioned Nottingham a few times already. You're not from Nottingham, you're from Liverpool. So just first in as to how you eventually ended up in Nottingham, first of all, please.
Fairly straightforward. I ended up going to university in Sheffield to do a civil structural engineering degree. And I met Sandra, who became my future wife, in Sheffield. She was the year below me, but I did a 4-year course, so we finished at the same time. And I proposed to her in the last week of term of the last term of university.
Ah.
Wasn't massively romantic. I just kind of a bit out of the blue said, "Would you like to get married?" She said yes. Although she told me off because I'd deliberately not asked her sooner, because she had her final exams coming up and I didn't want to distract her. So I felt it was more appropriate to wait until after she'd finished her finals. After she finished her finals, she went home for a few days, then came back. And on the day she came back, I proposed to her. But she said to me after, when I said to her, "I've left it till now to propose to you," she said, "It's been driving me mad. I've been waiting for you to propose to me for ages." That was a bigger distraction than not asking me. The things you learn, really. I also made the mistake of not having, it didn't even occur to me that I should have an engagement ring for that moment. So she then dragged me out to buy an engagement ring for her, which I then had to borrow some money off her to pay for. So anyway, we both finished at the same time. We were both applying for jobs. She ended up doing a fairly specialist job as a patent agent, which she got a job in Nottingham. I was applying for jobs as a civil engineer, which at that time there was a construction industry boom and I could have got a job anywhere. But because she got a job in Nottingham, I got a job in Nottingham. Turned down the opportunity to work for a much better company. But that's how we ended up in Nottingham. And we've been there for 36 years now, thereabouts.
Wow. As if men don't understand women, as if.
Oh, come on.
Yes. Well, I can hear some men applauding. Well done for that's what I did sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's move straight on to more important things than if that's okay.
Yeah.
Now that you're in Nottingham and you're working as a social engineer, where were you spiritually at this time?
So I'd grown up in a Christian family. Really, just before I was about to go to university when I was about 18, I was at a point where I was thinking, I think I'm going to give this Christianity lark a break for a while I go to university and I can enjoy the social life and all that kind of thing. But just before then, Billy Graham came to Anfield.
Uh-huh.
My mum volunteered me to be a steward, and I put the emphasis on volunteered. I didn't get any say in the matter at all. She volunteered me to be a steward at the Mission England mission with Billy Graham at Anfield. And on the last night, even before Billy Graham got to speak, there was a guy whose name I can't remember, stood up as a kind of warm-up act and basically said, if I was the only person in the world, Jesus would have chosen to die for me. And when I heard that, I thought, if that's what Jesus is like, then I want him to be my Lord for the rest of my life. And I waited for ages for Billy Graham to shut up so I could go down and stand on the pitch and really renew my faith in Jesus, really. So by the time I got to university, I was a bit full on. I was really fired up to follow Jesus, and I got up to some fairly crazy things, kind of evangelistically, as it were, whilst I was at university. Probably some more embarrassing moments there. As I was approaching the end of university, I went through a phase of thinking, should I be going into some kind of full-time ministry? But got a sense through speaking to various people that needed to wait. So I went into civil engineering, but really wanting to throw myself into the life of my local church and see what difference I could make and that kind of thing, really.
Mentioning Billy Graham at Anfield, Billy Graham went to Ashton Gate as well, the home of Bristol City, yeah, where I saw him. I remember interviewing, this is going back 30-odd years ago now, with a vicar who was attached to a very famous football team that wasn't Liverpool or Everton. He was the chaplain there, and he had gone through similar sort of thing. I ended up at Anfield, and he was a bit of a rogue at this time, to say the least, wasn't a Christian. And he went there deliberately so he could make a mark on the pitch, dig it up, because he hated Liverpool so much.
Oh, okay. Well, that is my one time I've been on the pitch at Anfield.
There you go. Was it covered at all? I don't think it was,
no. No, it wasn't, actually. No, it wasn't. It was the turf itself, yeah. I doubt you'd be able to do that these days. There'd be nothing precious about it.
You wouldn't be allowed on the pitch. You know, they'd have to have a 3-foot of tarpaulin over it, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So there you are in Nottingham then. It's fascinating to hear how people have a really good job and then give it all up, like you did.
Yes. Yes.
I can bear testimony to that as well. So what actually happened? Tell me more, please.
I worked as a structural engineer for 16 years, and I got to the point that I became a company director of a small but growing local engineering consultancy. At some level, that was fine. I was doing really well in my career. But two things happened simultaneously, really. One, I was increasingly really exploring the idea that I wanted to give more of my time, I suppose, to serving God's kingdom, in whatever form that might mm-hmm. take, with working with a church or whatever. I'd looked into ordination a bit, but that didn't go very far. My wife hated the idea. We weren't sure whether it was a good fit. But then two things happened. One is my employers, who I had thought were very good ethically, as it were, and were wanting to develop a company that thought about and cared about their staff and all the rest of it. Sadly, what happens when money becomes the pressure that it is, people make decisions that aren't always the ones I would choose, really. And things got difficult. They made one or two decisions about staff that I was really, really unhappy about, that were based on the need to save money more than anything else. And I know from being a director and later on being a director of a charity that you do have difficult decisions to make sometimes. Integrity really matters. And so there were some really difficult decisions they made. And I got to a point of thinking, I need to move on from this. At the same time, my church started to advertise that they wanted somebody to work for them as an evangelist and to look after a church plant they had at the time. So I thought, I'll have that job.
Yeah.
And I spoke to the vicar about it. And I think both he and I are the sort of people that will see an opportunity like that and find a way to make it work and worry about the protocols and policies and things afterwards, really. Not everybody agreed with that approach. So it took ages from the point where we thought, okay, I'm just going to get this job. It took nearly a year before that things really began to slot into place. The advertised for the job, it was quite something really, because the advertised for the job, we got shortlisted along with a couple of other people to be interviewed for the job. Just before the interviews took place, the vicar resigned.
No.
And it all went completely pear-shaped.
Yeah.
But then the next thing that happened a week or so later is that was, I think the vicar chose his time to resign. A new church council was voted in at the church's AGM, and they decided that the job was still on after all. So they then interviewed us. I think that's the right sequence. And then they couldn't make the mind up who to give the job to. So they decided to recruit two of us, both myself and another guy, and they actually changed what the job they were offering me. They offered me a job as a evangelist, but also as a children's worker, family worker, which actually suited me very well because I've done a lot of that sort of stuff. So that was a really good fit and actually made things a whole lot simpler. Then there was just the small matter of needed to raise some funds to make sure that was possible. So
yes,
he said, we'll put this to the congregations, share the vision with them, and then we'll have a giving day to see whether or not people will be prepared to cover the cost, really. And that was really weird, because a fortnight later, they had a giving day. And I was leading the service on that day. I don't know to this day how many people knew or not that I was potentially in post for the role that they were seeking to pay for. But I had to be the person that stood there with the big tray that people come and put their gifts or their pledges on.
Yeah.
Knowing that it was kind of my job on the line sort of thing. So it was really weird. But the money came in, they gave me the job, and I gave up my director's salary and took a 50% pay cut and started working for the church.
Yes, a 50% pay cut. Yeah.
But weirdly, and I still can't figure this out, we were financially better off afterwards.
Why?
I don't know. I've never been able to figure it out. Whilst I was working as a company director, I mean, we were doing all right. You know, we had a small overdraft facility that we'd dip into to keep cash flow going or whatever. But after I moved into the job with the church, we never seemed to need to use that. And I cannot, for the life of me, I've never been one for working out monthly budgets and things. I'm a really bad example in that sense. Really, don't follow my example. But it just seemed to me that we just had enough and it's continued to be the case ever since, really.
Well, first worked for a Christian ministry. I remember asking Derek Cleave, a very well-known evangelist and one of the early podcasts as well. And I said to him, how long have you been living by faith? And he said, 21 years. He said, why do you ask? I said, well, I'd like some advice, please, because obviously that's what I've got to do. And he said, well, a very simple question. How long have you been living by faith so far? And I said, 18 months. He said, well, there you go. I said, what do you mean, there you go? He said, well, you survived the last 18 months, so you'll survive the rest.
Yeah, I think that's about the size of it, really. I think you just have to keep trusting. I mean, one of the things that was quite amazing, really, was I'd waited a year to get for this job at the church to slot into place, and there was all sorts of faffing about to get to that point. Just before I finally got the job, my wife, who at that point had our second child, was not going to return to her previous job. She was starting to do a little bit of private music teaching from home. But my daughter, who was at primary school, her violin teacher retired quite suddenly. And so the school offered my wife the job to be the violin teacher. She had like a 2-minute interview and they told her to get on with it.
No strings attached.
So overnight she was able to start earning again, which obviously helped. She now does that sort of job 3.5 days a week or whatever it's done ever since. So, you know, God just provided. And it's strange now, because I now find myself the current situation I'm in, the job that I do now, I now really have the attitude that it's up to God, really. If he wants me to carry on doing it, he'll provide for it.
Mm.
I mean, I say that now. I think you've been through the same experience. Learning to relax about that and just let God take care of it, it takes some time to get to that point. And you do have your moments when you think, really?
I think that's part of my problem, actually, trying to relax, as my wife will continually remind me. You know, I've just got to learn to relax.
Yeah.
Majority of the time, I can't. That's my battle, yeah.
It's not easy. It's really not easy. I think part of my story, and it's there in the book, is that God just provided so miraculously so many times that I've kind of learned to say, well, if God wants this, he will provide for it. Although I went through quite a phase of really, really working quite hard and being on my knees pleading for funds and all the rest of it, I think sometimes God allows us to say, you know what, just relax.
Just chill.
Just chill. I've got it. Now, it's not always like that. I wouldn't want anybody to think it's always like that, but that seems to me what God is saying to me at the moment. Just chill. Just take it.
But how many times do we hear that comment that you've just made? Oh, well, if God wants me to do it, he'll provide, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which I take as often just a blasé attitude because you don't really mean it, compared to actually really meaning it.
You do hear it a lot, and I'm trying not to be blasé about it, because I have to say, it's been through a pretty painful learning curve to get to that kind of point, really. And the thing I say in my book, really, I think there's three things that if you're running a charity or a Christian mission or something, there's three things you got to do. Number one, fundraising strategy, pray. I mean, that's obvious in a way, but I really do mean pray. You know, no question about it, really, because there are sometimes that is the only thing you can do. So it should be the thing you always do. The second thing is you've got to act with integrity. God is very, very gracious. But if you start fiddling the books or whatever, I don't think God is going to honour that for very long, really.
Yeah.
I think you're pushing your luck. And it doesn't, you know, you wouldn't want to do that. So you've got to act with integrity. And then the third thing, you have got to work hard. You've got to take the opportunities when, I mean, it's all very well saying God will provide, but sometimes God puts stuff in your path and you've got to pick it up and take it. You can't just expect it all to flow into your bank account and do nothing about it at all. You have got to take the opportunities when they arise. And there are occasions where you just have to work hard.
Yes.
The charity I now work for, two of the trustees just a couple of weeks ago, I wouldn't do this, but they decided to do a sponsored skydive to raise funds, which is wonderful. And I've done all sorts of crazy things, but that one was too far. I'm not jumping out of a plane.
And there was that old joke, wasn't there? Someone was parachuting down towards Earth. His parachutes didn't work. And he sees this bloke coming up, shooting past him without a parachute, straight up. And he shouted out to the bloke, "Oi, do you know anything about parachutes?" And the bloke said, "No. Do you know anything about exploding gas cookers?" Anyway.
Yes.
Moving on. I don't want to go into the situation that you just shared there about, or the pain that you'd gone through in a three particular painful incidents, because I'd like people to buy the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So we won't talk about that. But I would like to know more, first of all. That's okay. You said you were in the running, and in the end, the job was made into two jobs.
Yeah.
What happened to the bloke who took the second job, and what was his or her role on it?
His role became, there was a church plant that the church had set up previously, and they needed, appeared to need a kind of professional paid minister to look after that. It got to that stage. So part of his role was to do that, and part of his role was to look after the youth work. So he did that and took on that side of things and left me to focus on kind of evangelism and family ministry and stuff. And that it worked for me because it allowed me to kind of spread my wings a bit. Mm-hmm. And for me, and as will become more obvious, I think, particularly if you read the book, I kind of make no distinction between evangelism and social action and community work. It's all one, really. It's all good news. And I think it gave me the kind of freedom to experiment with that rather than having to have a congregation to look after.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you work well together.
Did we work well together? Yeah, not brilliantly, to be honest. Yeah, that's probably another story. I mean, I got on well enough with him. That's it. That side of things didn't work out. I wasn't so much of an issue with me, but it didn't work out brilliantly well. I'd leave it at that, shall we say.
Yeah, because that could make a whole new book as well.
Yes.
On how to work with Christians who maybe have different understanding what the job means and everything else.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Moving on then. But something you did say earlier on, and I'd like to ask you more about this, if that's all right, especially when you talk about money and the integrity of money. Now, I have seen firsthand from my previous career that setting up a Christian business is a great idea.
Yeah.
But when money gets involved, all of a sudden, God becomes second.
Yeah.
Even though you can justify it by having regular prayer meetings every day with your staff and all these sorts of things, when you've got like £1 million or £2 million coming in, you're thinking, oh, business.
Yeah.
Rather than what does God actually want?
Yeah.
So what have you seen on this?
I think it's such an important issue. In some respects, I wish it wasn't such an important issue, because I think there is only one way to approach this, and that's to follow God's vision. And like I said before, really, if you find yourself pursuing your own vision, then I think there'll come a point where God won't keep funding that, really. And I think if you find yourself pursuing the funds, I think sooner or later you'll fall foul of that. Ultimately, if you try and follow what God is leading you to do, you put your trust in him. And if it comes out the way you hope, then glory to God, really. A few years ago now, I went to a fundraising conference that was run by Stewardship, and there were some great speakers. There was Andy Hawthorne.
He's good.
And there was various people from other fundraising trusts. And there was, if there was a common message, it was that. They said, follow the vision. Andy said the same thing about fundraising as I did. Pray, really. Follow the vision. And everything, it's so important that that's what you keep doing, because the moment you start to dilute the vision to pursue the funds, then you end up doing something you didn't set out to do. This is not unique to Christian charities or churches, but there's quite a few charities I know of over the years that in order to raise enough funds, they'll change what they're trying to do just to keep the money coming in. And then they find themselves in a situation where they're perhaps competing with another organization that's already doing the same thing, or they get taken away from what they set themselves up to do in the first place. And you kind of think, well, what was the point of that, really? And it's understandable, because what happens if you get to a large size, you've got to keep the money coming in and keep the staff paid and all the rest of it. And it is really hard. But it's so important, I think, to come back to, well, what is this work for? Why are we even doing this? And if you go away from that to just make sure there's enough money coming in, well, you might as well jack it in and start to, you know, take up a different job altogether, really. I think it's such a key thing. And I have experienced it numerous times that the easier decision is to pursue what keeps the money coming in. I remember during COVID, I got rung up by another charity in Nottingham who wanted some advice on how to run a food project. And they were a youth project that was doing all sorts of stuff with youth work. So I said to him, why are you running a food project? Because at that time, there were food projects all over the place, and I was coordinating most of them. I said, why on earth do you want to run yet another food project? And he basically said, because we can get funding for it. We can't get any funding to do youth work at the moment because we can't do it because of COVID, but we can get money to run a food project. And I said, well, do you want to really think about that? There's enough stuff around. You know, I'm really sorry, but that's not the answer. And it's hard, but you've got to stick with the vision. That's what matters, I think, really.
Yes, which comes back again to living by faith, isn't it?
Yeah, it does. You stick with the vision. And it's really hard. It can be really tough sometimes, because it sometimes feels as though the money isn't there and you don't know where it's coming from next or whatever. And I was really blessed in the early days with staff and trustees that were willing to, with me, kind of take it to the wire, to be honest, really. There were times when we paid one or two people late, but they were willing to allow that because they believed in what we were trying to do, really. And that, again, is once you become a larger organization and more sort of corporate, that becomes a harder thing to do. I always remember reading, I think it's John Kirkby's book on Christian Against Poverty, his book, Nevertheless. Great book. And I remember reading it thinking, please, God, don't let me have to go through what he's been through. Because my goodness me, they had to take some risks, really. But he just, his faith carried him through it. And I'm not, again, you'd need a bit of a health warning to take that kind of approach, really. And it is tough, but I just think you've got to keep trusting. And the one thing I would say particularly is there will be times when you doubt, you begin to think, I think I should just stop now because there just isn't enough. And I think faith isn't the absence of doubt. Faith is keeping going even when you doubt. And what I've found is if you can keep going, then keep going. If there's any way in which you can keep going until you can't, until it's beyond your control, really. God seems to work through that.
I want to major on this, if that's right, the remaining time,
yep.
Because I just know from a previous podcast where the guest was absolutely brilliant and what he was doing with his Christian ministry was great, but he was having a series of doubts as to whether he should just chuck in his existing job to concentrate full time.
Yeah.
And despite saying things like definition of faith is trusting in God without a backup plan, which I try to hold on to, and my minister friend reminds me every so often that, you know, well, if you've got enough money to get through your next 3 weeks, what's your problem? It does hurt when you hear that,
yeah. But
you have to go for it. And I'm still here, but I'd like to know more, please, about yourself, if that's right, for those that maybe are being challenged right this moment about, well, God, what do I do?
Yeah.
So what else did you have to give up apart from, well, a regular salary? Tell us more about how you broke it to the family, what they said, and, you know, the process you went through.
When I went from working as an engineer to then work for my church, that was one level. Weirdly, in a way, the fact that my job as a company director was becoming increasingly fraught because I'd found myself in a position, I was working for employers that, to be honest, I thought I trusted but felt I could no longer trust, is the simplest way of putting it. So my wife saw my anxiety in that and she could see that a change was needed. So in one sense, that was kind of helpful. The next thing that really helped was that because it was my own church that was potentially offering a position to move into, and to be honest, a position that felt like a natural transition from being a volunteer in the church to being a paid member of staff. I was already involved in some of the kids' work. I was already involved in helping run Alpha courses. So to move from doing that in a voluntary capacity to a paid capacity, that really helped. And the fact that I wasn't becoming a vicar really helped. My children at that time were kind of young enough that they weren't too faced by it one way or the other, really. But for my wife, I think perhaps particularly because part of my role was working with families and doing kind of community outreach work, that felt more like something that my wife could cope with than kind of full on being ordained as a vicar sort of thing. And I realized much later, much longer after my wise wife, that actually me being a vicar would have been a terrible idea. I'm too much of a maverick, to put it mildly, really. So all those kind of things came together and they helped. And then when it came to a situation where I was working from a church and needing to give that up to set up Hope Nottingham, again, that went through a bit of a painful process. Things were becoming, relationships were getting strained for various reasons. And I was beginning to explore again, maybe ordination or whatever. The most amazing thing happened, really, and I feel very blessed that God dealt with both myself and my wife and the family all at the same time, really. We were in it together because I'd got to a point of really not knowing what to do. I knew that it was time to move on from working for my church. The opportunity to create this Hope ministry was emerging, and I'd got a bunch of people, friends, close friends, to pray with me. I didn't tell them what I wanted them to pray about. I just said, "An easy to pray with me." And so they did. And that was so helpful. And they prayed words of prophecy and various things. And that led to me getting in touch with a good friend of mine who was director of Derby City Mission at the time, Alistair. And for the first and only time, he responded to my email straight away.
I know that thing, yeah.
Went to see him the next day. And he said to me, "You need something like a city mission for Nottingham." And I thought I was just being called to maybe set up something just for the Beeston area of Nottingham. And he said, "No, you need to think about the whole area of Nottingham," which hadn't even occurred to me. But the moment he said it, I knew he was onto something. And my spirit told me, "Yeah, you've got to take notice of that." And I went home to talk to my wife about it. Now, my wife is the sensible person in our household, really. I come up with all the crazy ideas and my wife reins me in. And I said, "Alistair thinks I should set up this work for the whole of Nottingham." And she just said, "Yeah, that's obvious." I said, "What?" She said, "I know what you like." She says, "You'll set something up in Beeston, that'll get up and running, then you'll be on to the next thing." And she was right. And that's exactly what happened. We set up Hope House in Beeston, and within less than 18 months, that was up and running, getting established. And I was already on to other parts of Nottingham to help set up things there as well and similar kind of work. So it grew from a network, well, one place in Beeston in a disused United Reformed Church. It grew from that to a network of 14 or 15 within 3 years, because my wife knows me better than I know myself, I think. Really. God just seemed to bring together the right things at the right time. I've kind of glossed over some of the pain and that, and the soul searching that goes on with all that. And sometimes my wife wondering what on earth I'm up to. But at the right time, God brought the right things into place to make things go forward, really.
So that's one thing to look out for. Then if you're in that position whereby you feel that you ought to take a step of faith and give up your job, but then, as we've already alluded to, the financial aspect of coming into your brain cells thinking, well, who's going to pay the mortgage? How are you going to get the mortgage and all that sort of stuff? Where did you stand on that?
My church, as in my employers, when I announced to them that I was going to stop working for them, handed my notice in, and I was going to set up Hope Nottingham as a charity, they actually agreed to cover my salary for 3 months while I got the whole thing set up.
Wow.
So that was a huge blessing straight away. I was very blessed in lots of ways because, you know, if you're trying to set up a ministry, you need to know that you've got supporters in place, really. And I was very blessed that the work that I'd been doing had built up a lot of friendships, a lot of fairly wide support network, both within my own church and further afield. And one of the things I've discovered with fundraising particularly, that you have to get over a certain amount of embarrassment because your first funders will be your friends. And that's exactly what happened, is that that's what got us started. It was enough people were willing to put in a bit of money between them to help us get started. After that, we started to apply for the grant funding. It's extremely difficult to get grant funding if you've got no baseline whatsoever, whereas having some friends as supporters providing that kind of baseline to get started with really helped. Having also been a company director, that has helped enormously because I know how to run a business. I know what my strengths are and what my weaknesses are. Knew what we needed to get in place, just because charities in some respects aren't massively different from running a business. There are some things that are common to both. And so I'd learned a lot of that already, really. So I was able to get some of that stuff in place straight away. One of the things I knew was that you do not want me doing the bookkeeping.
Very good.
Because I'm rubbish at that kind of thing. I'm not a detailed person. I don't keep on top of that kind of thing. So I knew from day one that was something I had to find somebody else to do and do well. And that's always remained the case. It may not be universally true, but I suspect most people who are of a pioneering nature may not be the best people to do the bookkeeping. So if you're a pioneering type person, for goodness sake, find somebody else to look after the finance for you in terms of the day-to-day of it. My role that I have now is a kind of advisory role. And I was sat with a friend of mine who runs a refugee-based charity in Nottingham now. And I sat down with him not so long ago. And he talked to me about the pressures that he's under. And one of the things he talked about was the fact that keeping on top of the bookkeeping, the accounts and stuff, was just taking up so much of his time. And actually, that wasn't meant to be his role. He's meant to run the charity and the activities the charity's run. And I said to him, you've just got to find somebody else that will look after that for you. And it's a big, big part of getting anything like this set up is know your strengths as best as you can. Know your strengths, know your weaknesses. Be honest with yourself. Allow other people to be honest with you so that you can not dig a great big hole for yourself by doing things you're not very good at.
Or in my day, when I was a training officer, that'd be called facilitating.
Yeah.
You know, and how many times have we seen Christian ministries suffer because the person is suffering from burnout?
Yeah.
They can't cope anymore. Their mental health has completely and utterly declined. And when you look at it, it's like, well, why are you doing the bookkeeping? Why are you doing the fundraising? Yeah. Why are you doing this? Why are you getting to make all the coffees and teas? You know, how much of that is you trying to control everything?
Yeah.
Learn to share. So what can you remember of that time?
Well, the whole flip side to that, I kind of make this, I'm the opposite of the control freak. I like to talent spot. If somebody comes to me and gets involved in what we're doing, I kind of like to try and understand what they're really good at. And then I encourage them to do it. And if they can do something I can't do, then they are worth their weight in gold. I think it's a really, really important thing to try and get to grips with, because the flip side to all this is if you want to develop a Christian community, and this is what my book is really about is if you want to grow a Christian community through helping people in different ways, through whether it's food bank or debt advice or whatever it is, if you want to really help people, one of the most wonderful things you can do for them is to enable them to be part of a loving Christ-centered community. Just for me, that's why I wrote the book. It is the most blessed thing to be a part of. But people who are part of a community become part of a community because they get to join in. They get to be part of the family. If it remains me and my volunteers giving out stuff to people that come in the door, they take what we give them and they go again, that's not community at all. But if it becomes people that come in, get some help from us so that we can kind of get them on the feet, as it were, and then encourage them to join in, to offer that whatever it is they might want to do or might have an idea to do or to be good at, then what you start to have is a community where everybody joins in and where the person that may have come in originally for a food parcel or whatever becomes somebody that blesses me.
Yeah.
That's priceless. And I think it's a bit of a picture of the kingdom of God, is where everybody gets to join in and bless each other and learn to live together in the presence of Jesus. That's what it's about. And that can only happen if you let go of control, if you allow people to be what they're good at and encourage them to do it. I have this approach where if somebody comes to me and says, I think it would be really good if we could do this activity, my response to that is, great, get on with it. Not, oh, okay, I'll see if I can sort that out for you. We have to allow people to do what they have a heart to do and they have the ability to do.
Also, as well, as I've been told by some really, really important people, that in order for me to get to the next level, I need to do this on YouTube, need to do that on YouTube, do this, that, and put it all together. And I can't do it because A, I've got no understanding of video technology. B, I don't want to understand how to do it. And C, because of the situation at home, I haven't got time to do it anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm just trusting now that if that is what God wants to happen, then someone will come along. And I've had a couple of people come along and say, yeah, I'll do it. Then it all falls apart. So here's my advert, in light of what you're sharing. If there's anybody listening today that knows how to do video editing, for goodness sake, please get in touch with me.
There might be somebody who's listening now who thinks, you know what, I've been looking for that opportunity. And that's one of the things, really. You sometimes just got to ask.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there I've done it.
Yeah. But there's also, you've just explained it, really. There are some things that I have deliberately chosen not to learn how to do.
Such as?
Well, for example, anything to do with computers. Mate, I mean, I'm reasonably good with computers. If a computer suddenly ended up with a blue screen, I wouldn't have a clue what to do with it. And the bookkeeping I've already mentioned, there's things like that. I've realized sometimes it's better, particularly if you're in charge of an organization, it's better to have some things that you can't do. Because otherwise, everybody just comes to you to fix everything and they don't take responsibility for it themselves. So you've kind of got to have some things where you say, sorry, I can't help you. We need to find a different way to fix that. That way you share it.
Also, and I'm looking at the time now, we're rapidly approaching towards the last question. What about being able to just say no?
This is an interesting one because a lot of people said to me that, particularly in the early days when things were growing so fast, people would say to me, surely at some point you need to slow down, you need to stop saying yes to everything.
Yeah.
Depends how you set things up. I think God just used my instincts. I do so many things by instincts. But one of the things I'd done by instinct is any of the activities that we ran do not rely on me to do them. None of them. The various food banks, the various job clubs, all these different things, different volunteers, and then eventually different members of staff, they did those things. I didn't. So the limit to what we could do was not me.
Yes.
I was kind of the permission giver, really, an encourager, but it didn't require me to take on more and more work because actually what happened is other people were offering to do it. There are times when we need to learn and know what our capacity is. And one of the things I discovered and one of the reasons why I finally realized it was time to hand not hope not him over in terms of leadership is it became so big that I was finding myself spending more and more of my time being manager of an organization and no longer a kind of missional pioneer. And once I realized that, I realized it was time to say no to carrying on being the director of the organisation. It was time to hand it over to somebody who actually enjoyed all that organisation stuff.
You see, that's important, isn't it, to do that? To know when to give up and when to hand it on.
Yeah.
But also, it means you can have more time on the golf course, if only.
Well, golf would be another embarrassing moment.
Well, I think it's only fair if you give a really nice plug to the book, because it's now available, as I said, in all Christian bookshops. So please plug that. But also, if anything's been said today that has made people think, oh, maybe I'd like to know more, perhaps you could give, please, your email address or a way of contacting you.
Yeah.
And if you do know anything about YouTube, you want to help me out, let me know as well. I've asked, so we'll see what happens.
That's right.
Nigel, tell us, first of all, the name of the book, please, and how they can contact you should they so wish.
So the name of the book is Communities of Hope. What it's about, it's about growing Christian community through social action. You can get it through all good Christian bookshops. You can get it online. You can now get the audio version with me reading it, which is quite an experience, online as well. One of the lovely things about that is different people that I don't know have read the book and they've got in touch. And some of them have said to me, I really identify with that. I get it. They understand what I'm talking about because they've been involved in similar kind of work. And what's kind of hopefully coming next, it's enabling the development of an idea of a what we're calling a kind of community hub network across the country to enable people to support and encourage and learn from one another. And particularly with an emphasis on how we do that in a specifically Christian way that allows people to grow as Christians in that kind of context, really. So that's quite encouraging and quite exciting. That's where we are now.
It sounds as if we need to do another podcast in a couple of years on that one, Nigel.
Yeah, or sooner. Who knows?
Right, we'll sort that out. Maybe on a boat, just be looking at bears going past as well.
That sounds good. That sounds a great way of doing it.
Oh, there is Yogi. Brilliant. Well, thank you for that. And if they want to get in touch with you.
So my work email address is nigel@transformingknotstogether.org.uk.
N-O-T-T-S. Especially for our American friends.
Just Google Transforming Knots Together. You'll get the website and you can contact us through that.
Well, Nigel, looking forward to meeting you again in a year's time. We can hear more about what's going on. But before then.
Yes.
Nigel Adams. Who is your Christian hero, please?
So my Christian hero would be Desmond Tutu. Now, this is not particularly because of the South Africa connection, just because that guy was so full of joy. I mean, he dealt with some horrendously serious stuff in South Africa in his life. But whenever you heard him, whenever I've heard him speak once at the NEC in Birmingham in the late 80s, and he was just so funny. And so full of joy, and he was infectious. He just had this contagious humor, which is just amazing. And how he was able to do that in spite of really living with horrendous situations in his homeland. Like, it's such an incredible example to follow.
Yeah.
He's just a lovely, lovely man. Another example to follow, really. I remember going to see him, as I say, at Birmingham NEC. We went with my wife's church to go and listen to them. And we just had a great time because he loves Jesus, he loves people. But there was a particular thing that I think he is such an example for the present age, for every age. He came up with this idea of a rainbow nation, this idea that it's not about them or us, about one side winning over or getting revenge on their oppressors. The only way we can live at peace with one another is to be what he called a rainbow nation, where everybody comes together, whatever their differences are, and learns to bless one another with all their diversity that goes with it. And I think, well, gosh, we need that. We need to learn how to live like that. So great guy and very funny guy as well.
That's a great answer. Can't remember the last time someone chose him, so great choice. For those that know hardly anything about Archbishop Desmond Tutu, what else do you know about him historically?
My recollection, he was educated in England, I recall. And one of his earlier experiences that really began to shape him is that whilst he was in England, as a young black man, his experience of encountering white people in South Africa was not very positive at all. Really. But it was one particular occasion that stuck in my mind that he was kind of walking along the street and he encountered a white policeman who was polite to him and made way for him. And that had a really profound impact on him. It probably gave him a sense of hope because, gosh, actually, it doesn't have to be like this. But his whole attitude towards other people was, there's a quote from Desmond Tutu that I really like, which kind of sums him up in a way. He basically says, we may be surprised at the people we find in heaven. God has a soft spot for sinners. His standards are quite low. I just love that. I think that's great.
Brilliant.
I think sometimes as Christians, we forget it's about grace. Desmond Tutu personified that, really.
That's a great answer. Nigel, thanks so much for joining us today. Cheers. God bless.
Great to be with you.
Bye. Next time on Off-Grid Christianity.
This is what I love about the Bible, is it doesn't tell you a lot of stuff. It makes you wrestle with it.
We used to have a song about that.
What was the song, Noel?
I haven't a clue, but I grew up with all these terrifying stories of what God did to people, and we had nice, happy songs about it.
Yeah.
Like, God caused all these people to drown. Isn't our God wonderful?
We're getting a little controversial here, Martin. You'd better pull us back.
So I grew up with a God that basically does nasty things to people, and we sing happy songs about it.
Has Noel Richards ever written a bad song where it's full of death and gloom and doom? You haven't, have you? Not yet.
I've written some pretty bad songs, which would make you want to listen to somebody else.
So please join me for a very special Christmas edition of Off-Grid Christianity with guests Noel Richards and Martin Scott. Until then, cheerio.